got a news centre at 6. The leader of Kensington and Chelsea Council is standing down following the Grenfell Tower fire. Nicholas Paget-Brown's been under increasing pressure, and last night the authority refused to hold a cabinet meeting in front of the public and journalists. He says that's partly why he's resigning, as well as anger among residents that their concerns aren't being addressed.
I have to accept my share of responsibility for these perceived failings. In particular, my decision to accept legal advice that I should not compromise the public inquiry by having an open discussion in public yesterday has itself become a political story.
BCFMradio.com.
I assure you, no matter what significance you may hold for me, to the village and its committee, you are merely citizen number 6 who has to be tolerated and, if necessary, shaped to fit.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Most of World War II's nuclear scientists were from Germany and Eastern Europe. So did Hitler test a nuclear weapon 8 months before the Allies? An intelligence report made public for the first time this year reveals evidence the Nazis may well have successfully tested an atomic bomb roughly 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July, 1945. Two Luftwaffe staff and a delegate from Italy described seeing Hitler's mushroom cloud near the North German city of Lübeck early in October 1944. Also in his book Critical Mass, US writer Carter Heydrich looks at a shipment of Nazi-enriched uranium needed to build the atom bomb, which was shipped off at the end of the war to Japan, but eventually ended up in the hands of the Americans. Plus, hate preacher Tommy Robinson, another British-based Jewish group, Jewish Voice, has condemned him this week for inflaming hatred against Muslims, the same way as Hitler scapegoated the Jews. But how come the police protect his freedom of speech? And what about the far-right factories that foster this racial hatred? The so-called far-right incubator groups. We have a chat to former US Naval Intelligence Officer, Agent Kenyon Gibson, who infiltrated some of these London fascist groups. Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, Kalpner Wolf has a charity, 91 Ways, which brings together Bristol's ethnic groups around the meal table. And our taxes funding Bristol charity Happy Cities. How would you feel if you're about to be evicted? That it's your fault? You're just not happy enough. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. And if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But I'm joined on the line now by Carter Heydrich, who wrote that book Critical Mass back in the 1990s. Hi, Carter, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for welcoming me, Tony. I appreciate the opportunity.
Could you just give us an idea of what first put you on the scent of this submarine? It was a Nazi submarine that left right at the end of the Second World War, but it was initially heading for Japan. It ended up in the United States with a cargo, we believe, of enriched uranium on board. But what first alerted you to this?
I actually started my professional career in the film business. I spent 10 years as a freelance filmmaker, writer, director, doing lots of things. One of the producers I had worked with knew I liked history and introduced me to an old German gentleman who had been in the German Third Army that was surrounded by Stalingrad. He was one of the barely 5,000 survivors out of 335,000 that were taken prisoner or killed. And we had an interesting discussion. He had found a couple of, I won't go into the background of why he was looking, but his family was asking for reasons why he did what he did. And so he went searching for stuff, and he came up with a couple of documents, kind of one of them said that there was uranium on a U-boat that was surrendered to the United States, and the other one said that Martin Bormann was tied to that U-boat. And that's really all he really had. And they said this proves that the Germans made an atomic bomb and that the United States stole it from them, and that's what we used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And my response was, at that time, the Manhattan Project history was really kind of indelibly etched, and still is, you know, the primary history of the United of the birth of the nuclear age. And my response was, well, we got two problems here. Well, we got three problems. First problem is this is really recent history, so it's pretty new and prevalent. Second one is just by nature of its technicality, its scientific nature, it's probably the most documented piece of history ever. And the third one is you've only got two documents, and you're not going to be able to change, you know, what is written and endeared to so many people, including me at the time, frankly. And my response at that point was, you know, I don't think you have anything here. Where there's smoke, there may not be fire, but we ought to at least look and see what's causing the smoke. And before we make the film, because when we make a film, it'll never be, if it is true, it'll never be proven with the film. It'll actually debase the argument because of the artistic license it's taken in feature films. So I said, you know, let me do a little checking and see what's here. If there's nothing, we'll go ahead and make a fun fiction film. And if there is, then this really needs to be put in a book and fairly documented and put up for critical review so it can be established as the real history. So that's how I got into it.
Now, this U-boat was apparently it's a bit weird because the enriched uranium is called U-235, but the U-boat is called U-234, U for U-boat or U for uranium. And apparently it docked at Portsmouth Naval Shipyard in Maine on the 19th of May 1945, just after the end of the war in Europe, just a couple of weeks after, with 560 kilograms of U-235. You discovered evidence of an alleged synthetic rubber plant, I understand, as well at Auschwitz, that devoured more electricity than the city of Berlin, but it never produced any synthetic rubber. So did you dig up any evidence that the Nazis had actually been enriching uranium?
Well, yeah, there's all kinds of evidence that they had been enriching it. The key ones are that, let me back up a step, there's two ways to make an atomic bomb. One is with uranium, the other is with plutonium. And the Nazis had made a mistake in calculating some stuff for their uranium bombs, and they decided to focus on a plutonium bomb. At least that's the story that General Gross, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, gave after the war. In reality, there was a gentleman by the name Von Ardenna, a baron by the name of Von Ardenna. He was actually the guy who invented the first television to broadcast TV, which was at the Munich Olympics. And he...
The other person has cleared.
Oh, well, we seem to have lost him. Martin, we'll try and get Carter Heydrich back, but the implications here are that actually there were being deals, very important deals being done for this uranium at the end of the Second World War.
Well, it's interesting to speculate if that was the case. I mean, as you know, on this show, we have looked into what deals were done, particularly between Bormann and MI6 and the CIA towards the end of the war. And it's pretty clear, for example, when we see the former head of the Gestapo, Reinhard Gehlen, far from being punished at Nuremberg, he ends up running the German BND secret services at the end of the war. So it's pretty common knowledge that senior Nazis were integrated into what became NATO's intelligence structure at the end of the war. But the actual allegations that are made here are new to me. I'm not saying that I disagree. I would love to hear more, but we seem to have lost our...
No, we've got him back now.
We're back now.
Just to run through this article, which was in the Daily Mail and in the Daily Mirror in February this year, just before I went away for a month, so missed it. Anyway, secret files reveal Nazis tested nuclear nuclear bomb before end of World War II, as Adolf Hitler plotted to decimate Britain. And I know Churchill was very worried that a nuclear warhead would be put onto a V2, and that's why they put a big priority on getting rid of these V2 sites. The documents unearthed in an American archive suggest Nazi Germany may have tested an operational nuclear bomb before the end of World War II. Recently declassified file APO696 from the National Archives in Washington is a detailed survey of how far the Third Reich scientists got in the development of the atomic bomb. Now, hopefully, Carter, you're back again, but I know when, in your research, you found quite a lot of files had actually disappeared, didn't you?
Yeah, it was really interesting. When I went to look in the Oak Ridge NASA laboratory files, which is where our enriched uranium was created, you go into the archives and you go into the findings and you pull whatever documents look interesting. And when I went in there, I asked for 38 boxes of documents. And when they delivered them to me, all but four still had their classification seals on them. So the primary seminal documentation of what actually happened in the United States side of enriching uranium, at least, had not even been looked at by historians. I was the first one to open it. And in there, I found the uranium production records and all kinds of records that said that spoke to a decidedly different history than what had been given at the end of the war. Which, you know, was, you can understand at the end of the war with the Cold War coming, everything, you don't want to reveal everything, but now we're, you know, 70, 75 years later, it's time to look at this thing for real and see what really happened.
And now, this most recent documents from this declassified file, APO696, apparently, it's the daily newspaper in Germany, The Bild, that dug it out. So this is actually some primary research being done over in Germany, that there was investigations, research, development and practical use of the German atom bomb. But I think the newest thing is that these various eyewitnesses saying that they heard saw the mushroom cloud. A German test pilot, Hans Zintzer, is in the file. He is considered pretty good evidence. He says he's a missile expert, and he observed in 1944 a mushroom cloud in the sky during a test flight near Ludwigslust. His log submitted to the Allied investigators reads, "In early October 1944, I flew away 12 to 15 kilometres from a nuclear test station near Ludwigslust. A cloud shaped like a mushroom with turbulent billowing sections about 7,000 metres high stood without any seeming connections over the spot where the explosion took place." But I suppose the other implication of this, Carter, is that, that there was this potential plan anyway to use the nuclear weapons, not just against Japan, but also potentially against Russia too.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, in my book I cover several different kind of scenarios of what happened. It's important to understand that the United States was successful enriching uranium and was successful creating plutonium, but they weren't going to have either bomb before the end of 1945 or early 1946. The problem with that, for the United States at least, and all the allies, I think, was that Stalin had already said he was going to, and in fact did, declare war against the Japanese between when the Hiroshima bomb was dropped and when the Nagasaki bomb was dropped. And if you put that into a context of a military context of the time, he was already had a million men on his eastern front with Manchuria and China, and within 2 weeks after he declared war against Japan, he took over that territory, which protected his right flank. He was moving 3 million of his four million man army from Europe, where the war was ended, to Japan. So you think about 3 million Soviet troops, 600 miles across the Sea of Japan from Honshu, the main island of Japan, and if they could have jumped to Honshu and taken over Japan, in a heartbeat. Long before we'd had our nuclear bomb and ended the war or been able to put an operation on Honshu with conventional means. What that would have done was changed profoundly the complexion of the Cold War. The Soviet Union not only would have had East Europe, but they'd have had fundamentally all of the important pieces of the Asia-Pacific Rim, which Japan held. So you're talking Hong Kong, Singapore, China, Korea, Indonesia, all those resources and population, that would have made a profound difference. I think that's, in my mind, that's the most probable thing that would have happened. There are some others as well, but the war planners had to do something about that. When the uranium from U-234 came up, I think they grabbed it, they snatched it, and used it for their purposes to end the war, as they did.
How come it never ended up in Japan, where it was supposed to go? I mean, so that's where this U-234 U-boat apparently was heading. Why didn't it end up in Japan?
Because by the time the Germans actually had an atomic bomb, they had lost superiority in the skies. They couldn't deliver it to a strategic target without a high possibility that they would lose it. And there was somewhat of a risk in sending it to Japan. I think Nazis at the very highest level who created and controlled their bomb used it, and there's ample evidence that this is the case, and I covered it in my book, I won't get into all the details, but they negotiated it to the United States as a secret part of Operation Sunrise, which was Alan Dulles when he surrendered. He accepted or negotiated the surrender of Italy. That was part of that deal, and that deal allowed Martin Bormann particularly, but others, to survive the war and to maintain economic control of much of the previous German economy and help Germany revive after the war, which I believe is one of the reasons it revived so quickly after the war.
Now, on this U-234, sorry to interrupt you, but on this U-234, we're told there was just over half a metric ton of U-235, this enriched uranium. What sort of difference would that make to the ability of the Trinity test and the Manhattan Project to actually get operational bombs going?
Well, one of the things that you need to... everybody needs to understand is that while the uranium on the U-boat is part of the traditional history, and it's admitted to, there's books about it, the traditional history says that uranium was raw uranium and couldn't have been made into natural bomb. However, into a nuclear bomb. However, and you look at the documentation of how it's stowed and the handling instructions and the fact it was labeled U-235, I've got at least five world-class physicists and nuclear engineers that say that was enriched uranium, it wasn't raw uranium. So that right there changes the fundamental truth of what that uranium is. And then the question becomes exactly what you said. Okay, so what did they do with it? Well, they used it to, we were way behind in our uranium enrichment. They used it to complete our uranium bomb. And the U-boat also had proximity fuses. We were having serious trouble triggering the plutonium bomb. Proximity fuses, and there was a scientist on board the U-boat by the name of Heinz Schlicke, German scientist, and he provided the means to trigger the plutonium bomb. And by the way, he's a retired director of the nuclear weapons program at Los Alamos National Laboratory, which did the engineering and testing of the bomb. His name's Delmar Bergen. He promotes my book. He wrote the foreword to it. He's one of the five physicists I quote that say that my book is correct, that this is what actually happened.
So what was Delmar Bergen's role in the Manhattan Project?
He wasn't actually in the Manhattan Project. He didn't go to work Los Alamos until 9 years after the war. But as he, you know, developed knowledge and talked to these people, and through his own knowledge and understanding, as he read the evidence that I present in Critical Mass, he realized that the traditional history wasn't correct and that I had corrected. The official historian for Oak Ridge National Laboratory for the actual uranium enrichment site, his name's Ray Webb. He also endorses the book and says it should be in every library. It's the correct version of what happened.
Now, Winston Churchill in 1945 was voted out of office, but there was something called Operation Unthinkable. He was actually suggesting, and in fact he had to be kept kept off the BBC because he was seen to be a little bit batty about the idea that it would be possible to nuke Moscow. Immediately he was into the whole sort of Cold War thing. So in July 1945, there were already plans apparently to launch an attack on the Soviet Union. I just wonder what you make of that, because it seems as if that they were instantly and rather too quickly after the Second World War, the United States and Britain, and thankfully we had a new government in Britain that wasn't Winston Churchill, embracing the Germans and the Nazis in order to fight Russia.
I think it is. I think all of those things are very, very possible and probably true. I haven't studied that specific area. I don't know for sure, but it sounds logical that, you know, there was a whole large wing of the Allies, both in the UK and in America and elsewhere, that said, you know, we're over there. Let's finish the job and go on, so we know we're going to end up fighting the Soviets. And I could easily see people promoting using nuclear weapons there. And with you, I'm glad it wasn't done. I think that would have taken us down a terrible path. I think as scary and weird as it was to have mutual assured destruction in the Cold War, I think that we navigated it probably, you know, better than what would have happened had the other path been chosen.
What about, you mentioned Alan Dulles briefly, what was his role in all of this? Because I know he was involved in Switzerland, for example. I mean, he would have been very much in understanding what was happening to the Nazi loot from the Second World War, much of which was deposited in Switzerland. And so what was his role over stateside?
So he was, Franklin Roosevelt's direct link to Europe and the intelligence in Europe. He almost reported directly to Roosevelt, and not anybody else, as I understand it. And he, a little earlier in the war, I want to say later in 1943, a German who came to Dulles, his last name was Langbein, according to Dulles, and he presented some materials, some documents that talked about a commercial exchange between Nazi Germany and other foreign countries, and they didn't get specific about it. This man's last name was Langbein, and so I'm just going to leave that little pile of information right there for a second. A little later, not much later, a few months later, Dulles was approached again by emissaries from Karl Wolff, who was the plenipotentiary of Italy. Now, Karl Wolff had quite a background before he was plenipotentiary for Italy, which means he controlled, other than the military offensive and defense, the civilian population of Italy he was responsible for, and the occupation. Prior to that, he had been in charge of the synthetic rubber plant, the building of the synthetic rubber plant that you had mentioned earlier, that actually never created any synthetic rubber, used more power than the city of Berlin. And there's no explanation for what happened there until you compare the characteristics of that plant with the characteristics of the uranium enrichment plant at Oak Ridge, and all of a sudden you see, oh, that's what it was. It was an uranium enrichment plant. So Karl Wolff goes from there to be in the penitentiary of Italy and fairly quickly makes contact with Dulles and says, hey, let's talk about some negotiated surrender. And Dulles, you know, the open story, the legend, if I can call it that, is that the ally said unconditional surrender is the only thing we'll accept, and that's what Dulles supposedly told Wolff. But there's plenty of evidence that there was a sub-negotiation between very few people. Dulles, the gentleman, Dulles' right-man hand, Zero von Gavernitz, and Wolff and a few of his close associates himself. And that's when Wolff, who knew was responsible for creating the actual material, German material for a bomb, took it to the United States and said, if you give us this, if we will give you this if you give us protection after the war, allow us to escape and give us protection after the war. And there's, I don't want to get too grand and go down too many rat holes, but there's a bunch of information in the book that backs that up about how when Wolf was interrogated after the war, he was he actually talked to Adolf Hitler about negotiating the secret weapon instead of using it, because they couldn't use it when they after they lost air superiority. So that's where Wolf and Dulles plays in. Dulles is the one who headed on the United States side, the Allied side, the negotiation for not only the surrender of Italy's of Germany's southern front, but more importantly, the surrender of U-234 and its bomb components that then, you know, changed not only the tide of the war, the tide was set, but changed the end of the war and the players in the new world that evolved after that.
Yes, but I mean, there's a lot of people, sort of British historians, have sort of complained, I suppose, about the fact that we had Frisch and Piles, who'd originally developed in Birmingham the idea for the atomic bomb on the Allied side, went over to the United States. Churchill sent them over there to develop the bomb. But then, towards the end of the war, there was an agreement saying, well, actually, the United States is not going to share any of what the development has achieved with the British, and the British were shut out. So, you know, we developed our own bomb in the late 1940s and 50s. But I know, Carter, I think originally you wrote this book in the 1990s, but you had quite a lot of trouble getting it out there, I understand.
It was, I think I mentioned to you earlier in some private correspondence that it took quite a toll on my life. Yes, I spent quite a bit. I spent 10 years researching and writing it to begin with, as well as the amount of money I won't repeat here, but it was a lot. And wrote the book and put it out. Kind of, I tried to get journalists and historians, professors, to, you know, originally before I even tried to write it, to get them to say, "Hey, look at this," and nobody wanted to touch it. They said, "No way, that's real." And so, because I made my living as a communicator and knew how to research and knew how to write, I felt like, you know, there's a line in the movie National Treasure. I don't know if you've seen that, but somebody asked him why he's doing what he does. And he says, if you know something's wrong and you have the capacity to fix it, you have the responsibility to fix it. And that was the attitude I took. And so I dug in there and started going after it, and I came up with these revelations that really changed the course of history.
But it is in print now, so you've got a bit of a better publisher, have you?
It's in print. It's actually the first two editions were self-published because I couldn't get a publisher. I couldn't get anybody else to help me with it. Now, I will say the second edition actually ended up on the physical shelves of Barnes & Noble, which it was the 13th or 14th self-published book out of 6 or 7 million at that point to actually reach the shelf. So it did well. And then when it went out of print, over the course of the next 10 years, it became kind of a collector's item within the conspiracy theory community, and copies of the first or second edition, hard copies, were going for $450 to $600. So there was people out there realized, hey, this is true. They want to get the book. They valued it, but it was hard to get. When the discovery spent uranium that was documented to be left over from the Nazi atomic bomb project was made in Germany, it became obvious that I needed to update the book and put out a third edition. And so I put out a third edition about a year ago, and it's doing well. And fortunately, Trine Daily Publishers published it, so you can get this information now with the updates on it, you know, for a reasonable price for a book. But it was a grueling, hard process. It almost destroyed my marriage and my family, and I had to kind of double back and put everything away after the second edition and spend some time healing some wounds. A little personal, but it's part of the process.
Well, listen, Carter Hardrick, we'll put a link up on our show page to your book, to the Trine Day site. Thank you ever so much for sharing all that with us. And thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Tony. Thank you.
Now, Martin, interesting story, isn't it? And I think maybe one of the reasons why there was so difficult for him to get that published is because the links between Nazi Germany and the United States are almost weekly, we're seeing more and more evidence that that there was a tremendous amount of closeness between the two. Really, in a way, starting with the attempted coup in the 1930s by Prescott Bush, and the collaboration and cooperation, even in the 30s, between Nazi Germany and certain fascist elements within the US.
Yeah, and I think, don't forget that this isn't just of historical interest, is it? I mean, I think Carter there, perhaps naively thinking that this was just, you know, 70 years ago now, let's look into this. It's still live. And as I said earlier on, the evidence that elements within the Nazi state were protected and actually absorbed into the Western intelligence structure in the 1940s, I think that's overwhelming. The question is, how far did it go and how deep did it run? And if the elements within the Nazi regime helped the West to develop nuclear weapons as part of a deal to protect themselves, that would fit in with what we know about other things that went on.
Interesting, too, that Deputy Director of the Los Alamos, Delmar Bergen, Dr. Delmar Bergen, has endorsed his book.
Yeah, but as you pointed out, Bergen wasn't there at the time. But nevertheless, he's a nuclear scientist, presumably of some standing, otherwise he wouldn't be working at
Los Alamos. Deputy Director of Los Alamos.
Yes.
And has written the foreword to his book. I just also wonder what you make of these claims that we had the Nazis had a 9-month lead on the United States developing nuclear weapons.
Well, I mean, it begs the question, why didn't they use them? But it could well be, as we're discovering.
Well, as he said there, first of all, he said they didn't have a delivery system, although they did have the V-2. They may have decided to use their atomic bomb as a kind of bargaining chip.
Yeah, well, somebody decided to use it as a bargaining chip, because, of course, what the Nazis could have done, if they'd got a bomb, packed it onto a V-2, they could have nuked Britain, but they couldn't nuke the United States of America. And the United States of America would still be there, the biggest power on the planet, etc. It wouldn't win the war for them, would it? It just wasn't big enough. So you could see why elements within the Nazi state might say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to do a deal with the elements within the Western establishment with whom we've already got contacts going back to the 1930s.
Also, interesting what he was saying about, on the surface, it being unconditional surrender, and yet, at the same time, amongst a handful of people, deals were being done.
Yeah, well, I mean, that fits in what we've been saying about Martin Bormann escaping from Berlin. He was, as far as we know, rescued by a British squad, Royal Navy squad, led by John Ainsworth Davis. And I think that's because the Nazis themselves were not all in on the deal. It's quite likely that Bormann was double-crossing his boss Hitler by doing this deal. And that Hitler would have probably wanted to fight to the end with a nuclear bomb and all the rest of it. But, of course, others had a more kind of self-preservationary attitude.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, bringing it all up to the present day, we have a little bit of a problem, don't we, Martin, over in Syria at the moment. It looks as if, as the Russians and the Syrian government, not the Syrian regime, the Syrian government, retake their country. Also, we've heard this week that one of the most, or the last, isolated pockets of ISIS in Iraq has fallen in Mosul. So it does look as if this whole sort of ISIS menace is drawing to a close in Iraq, and at the same time it seems to be still surviving in Syria, except it also looks as if there's been an attempt. Well, on Monday there was a statement from Michael Fallon and from James Mattis, US Defense Secretary, that if there is another chemical weapons attack in Syria, it will definitely be Assad that's done it.
Well, I mean, they've been all over the place on that this week. I think it was Trump or was it Mattis was saying that we've got evidence that they're preparing another chemical weapons attack. Fallon was certainly saying it, like the one that we saw in Idlib, although all the evidence, Samuel Hirsch writing in Die Welt, German serious newspaper, and he's very, very serious, high-level investigative journalist, he says there was no evidence that the Assad regime used chemical weapons in Idlib. But nevertheless, we're being told that they did and that they're planning to do some more. And then Mattis, I think, came out and said, and now we're confident that they're not going to do it because we've threatened them and they've decided that they're not going to do it. Now, in other words, we're now dealing with a kind of Alice in Wonderland world where completely unbelievable allegations are made, and then they're withdrawn because the US military and the US establishment are at loggerheads about what to do here. Basically, their strategy of supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS to overthrow Assad has backfired spectacularly. It hasn't succeeded. It's caused a lot of pain and misery and death, but they failed militarily, and there's a danger now that they're going to double down, or elements within the military and intelligence community in the US are not prepared to accept defeat, which is why they're quite prepared to escalate at this point. But that's the fear, that they're not actually rational.
So we're going to have a look now at these US fascist incubators and looking at their purpose, really, which seems to be largely to do with sort of expansionism. That is to say, kind of privatised industries, privatised companies going in and making money from reconstruction, but also, Martin, private military companies making money and mercenaries making money. In fact, this is something the Russian President Vladimir Putin was saying recently, was that really it's just a question of who offers the more money, whether it's ISIS or the Free Syrian Army or al-Nusra, who these guys fight for over in Syria.
Well, ultimately what we're dealing with is a military industrial complex which makes its money through war and therefore goes around promoting war directly and indirectly, including supporting extremists of the left, the right and the Islamists in order to create enemies which they can then be employed to destroy. And it's a strategy of tension driven by greed, which we've got overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services have been engaging with for decades. But of course they've run up against the Russians who are wise to what they're up to and are not easily pushed over. So they're in a bit of a pickle.
Do you think the Russians are being bamboozled?
I don't think the Russians are being bamboozled. The problem for them is that they don't want World War III like any rational person wouldn't. They could take a much harder line than they have, but they're trying to find a way to deal with the situation, to diffuse the crazy war-mongering attitudes that they're coming across when they're dealing with Western interlocutors. But the way they're doing it is the very sensible way, which is not to confront them directly, just to leave them in a position where they can't really do what they want because they just can't.
Anyway, we're going to hear now from former US naval intelligence asset Kenyon Gibson now. He was also infiltrating drug gangs, I believe, in New York as well. And one of the things that he did almost in his spare time when he was living over here in the UK was to infiltrate fascist groups in London. But he did the same sort of thing when he was over in the United States recently, speaking to a guy called Michael Bagley. So anyway, let's hear it from Kenyon Gibson now. He's trying to look at these fascist groups and how they're completely connected with war and making money from war.
Michael Bagley. Bagley is head of a company called Jellyfish, and he used to work for Operations Intelligence. He was recruited by Jellyfish. He was sent to Syria, and I met him at Penn Station. I spoke to him undercover, acting as if I was a member of an international group of Nazis and terrorist supporters. He knew somebody in London named Jonathan Boulter, who is a serious Satanist and sadist and into all these groups. Boulter sent me an email saying that Syria was to become a mini Halliburton, and Bagley had the keys to Syria. Bagley represents one of the three branches of U.S. intelligence, and that's private intelligence, the other two being military intelligence and government intelligence, which is CIA, DIA, NSA, Homeland Security, etc. So private intel companies being used to do what they want, with the American government able to deny what's going on, but also these private intel agencies, as Bagley told me, he basically laughed at the notion that he was doing this for Americans. He's never been a serviceman. He told me flat out he was doing it for the money. And Trump comes to power in January of this year, and he doesn't know what's going on. The private intel companies just hope to create their mini Halliburton, make a lot of money like they've done elsewhere around the world and in Vietnam, as I just mentioned. So Trump sees a mess, and one day something bad happens, and his daughter comes to him and says, "Daddy, you know, kids are being killed." And Trump puts a stop to it in a very humanitarian way. I have to give him credit. He called and said, look, we're going to bomb you, so why don't you get out of the way, but we want to get rid of these chemical weapons. So no civilians were killed. There was no loss of American soldiers either. He did as the commander-in-chief ought to have done. He got some criticism. He got support. But he's acting, he was not acting out of a desire to hurt Russia, hurt Syria, or hurt anyone. And that's very important. Unfortunately, though, with secret actors like Michael Bagley and Jellyfish, a.k.a. Blackwater, as it used to be called, but it changes its name maybe because it's ashamed of its past activities, in there, nobody really knows what's going on. So Russia and America are brought to friction over the actions of people like Michael Bagley, just as America and Vietnam were brought to war because people like whoever the forces were that killed John F. Kennedy wanted the war for their own profit.
Well, that's interesting. I'm afraid I don't agree that Trump acted well there. Trump shouldn't have carried out the cruise missile attacks. He killed five children.
But look,
more
to the point, I mean, we're looking here at whether Syria is really nothing to do with whether chemical weapons are or aren't being used. It's all about Blackwater mercenaries and Halliburton.
Well, yes, I mean, that's pretty obvious, isn't it, to anybody who looks into this. The military-industrial complex has got its own interests. It likes wars because wars are where it makes its money.
And I guess what Kenyon is saying there is that because Trump is a property developer, it's quite easy to bamboozle him in situations
like this.
That's right.
He's not really competent to be running a show like that, is he?
Well, he's kind of pushing out most of his foreign policy to the generals.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, Trump's basically a chump. And he's easily bamboozled. He made the decision. The way he managed it is he told the Russians, yes, we're going to carry out this strike, but we're going to give you warning. And of course, therefore, no Russians were killed. But I'm afraid some children were killed nearby, five at least. And of course, it was supposedly because Ivanka got really upset about the children who died. And of course, the other thing about the original chemical weapons attack is it's quite likely that the rebels who we arm and train, they carried it out and killed those people. And therefore, we should be attacking them. And if we're going to attack them, we might as well attack
ourselves.
What's
the state of play with this chemical weapons attack? What do you think now? Who was behind it? What happened?
Well, the evidence, there's various theories floating around that there was some kind of chemicals released during an air attack on the,
because I understand Seymour Hersh has weighed in on this one.
But Seymour Hersh said what Seymour Hersh has got is he's getting the inside gen from people in the military. That's what makes his stuff so good. But of course, they've also got an interest in selling a certain line. Yeah, so we get inside information, but it's quite possible that he's only getting half the truth. The Russians have looked at the videos and they're pretty much convinced that the videos are fakes. That there is nothing happening here other than people pretending that something's happening. So, for example, the whole idea that it was sarin news is completely ridiculous because the people in the videos have got protective clothing on.
Potentially dramatising a situation like that is quite a powerful way, isn't it, of drumming up a market for people like Blackwater Jellyfish.
Well, of course it is. And of course, the whole thing about children are being killed by these evil people, that's a way to get people who aren't really paying attention, emotionally engaged, so that we can then go... I mean, of course, and it worked for Trump. He carried out the cruise missile attacks, the Tomahawk tweet, and then his opinion polls rating 60% of the US approved of what he'd done. That's because people are being bamboozled. They're being bamboozled by their own intelligence services. Intelligence services, as we've just discussed, learnt most of their techniques from the Nazis, who were integrated into those intelligence services when NATO was set up. Incidentally, I was reading this week Oliver Stone's interview with Putin, and Putin said, we've got overwhelming evidence that the snipers in the Maidan Square that killed the Holy Hundred in the coup in Ukraine were trained by NATO special forces. So in other words, not only are the Russians and the Syrians not engaged in these evil acts, we are carrying out those evil acts. And that means, if you're not a pacifist, Tony, that some top US, British and other generals either go to prison or get their brains blown out.
Well, another development this week, Jewish Voice UK has launched a social media campaign to fight Tommy Robinson and the far right. And I'm just going to read their statement out now, or parts of it anyway. Tommy Robinson has on a number of occasions attempted to co-opt the Jewish community to further his abhorrent Islamophobic rhetoric, presumably in an attempt to gain legitimacy off the back of the legitimate fears regarding rising anti-Semitism. They say now, let us be very clear, Tommy Robinson is not a friend of the Jews. He is he is a pernicious man, a purveyor of division and othering. Vision of the diverse Jewish community are in direct conflict with those things. Islamophobia is considered a new phenomenon by most, but it isn't. It's the foreign threat that racist elements in our society have been peddling for centuries. Now, this goes on, and I'll put a link to it on our show page. But, Martin, it's interesting to see Tommy Robinson saying, well, I'm sticking up for the Jews against Islam, but actually Jewish Voice UK, a Jewish media group, both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine, is saying, we want nothing to do with you, Tommy.
Well, I've never heard of the group before, but obviously I agree with what they're saying there. And it's very welcome that they've spoken out.
And also, when I spoke to Kemyon Gibson earlier this week, I spoke to him also about fascist groups in the UK, far-right and fascist groups in the UK. And he's talking here about fascist incubators. He's talking about the people behind Britain First and something called the New Left. And he also mentions again Michael Bagley in the United States. So here's former US Naval Intelligence agent Kenyon Gibson, who also worked infiltrating drug gangs in New York.
There was a range of groups, from small groups that had very few members, and you know, the fewer members, the more outraged they were. So there's a guy, Kevin Quinn. Kevin Quinn was probably the most outrageous because he openly claimed that he believed in Nazism and Red Mein Kampf. He had the least members, and he changed the name of his group from the November 9th Society to the British First Party. Then there was the British People's Party, which was very small. The British National Party, which was the biggest, but shied away from out-and-out Nazism. They had a lot of problems after they were infiltrated by a Guardian reporter in about 2008. And I got into a lesser-known group that has the most power of them all, called New Right. New Right had meetings of about 60 people once a month in London at a secret location. You'd come to a location, and then everybody would get a secret text telling you that wasn't the location, and Jonathan Boulter would show up and lead you to a pub. There'd be four speakers. I was a speaker on a couple of occasions, but mainly the speakers were all anti-Semitic. You had a range of people who were also anti-Muslim to Muslim-speaking who hated Jews. But anti-Semitism was a common denominator there. And there was a lot of networking going on. So some people in that group were just right-wing activists who had no clue, and they paid their $5 to sit in this group and have a pint downstairs. And then others were much more powerful, like Jonathan Boulter, who personally knew Adrian Davies QC, who knew the late Jonathan Bowden, who knew Darius Guppy, the man who punched out Princess Diana's brother. And so the more powerful elite in these groups went around the world and had contacts with people like Michael Bagley. They are rather silly groups. So let me explain. You're a taxpayer, and these funds that you give to the government every year get partially allocated to intelligence agencies, and in the U.S., private intelligence agencies, and these private intelligence agencies then turn around and use this money to create problems and wars and make money for themselves and their affiliates.
Well, that's a pretty good summary of what goes on. And the private intelligence agencies are pernicious. What's happened with the CIA, it's become a huge subcontracting exercise these days. But underlying all of this, there are even bigger fish who are playing geopolitical games on an even bigger level.
It sounds, from what Ken is saying, I mean, it's quite plucky of him, I suppose, to infiltrate these groups and even to get to speak on the same platform as serious anti-Semites in order to sort of keep his cover going. But effectively, we are in a situation where the far right does seem completely immune to any kind of arrests and prosecutions when it comes to actually fomenting Islamophobia.
Listen, what we believe, and we've got quite a lot of evidence to suggest it, is that both extremist Muslims and extremist right-wingers are being encouraged in their bad behaviour and their bad talking in order to create a conflict in society, which then allows the private security industry to make a killing pretending to sort it out. And it's, I think it's not insignificant that both the English Defence League and Al-Majah Haroun, one of the most extreme of the Muslim front organisations, both appeared simultaneously in Luton some years ago. And it's very, very bizarre that they both appear simultaneously, supposedly hate each other's guts, absolute excuse for a punch-up, but they just appear both at the same time, and I don't think that's an accident. I think we've got intelligence agencies who are, and private agencies, stirring the pot here. They want to see trouble. Trouble is their business.
And Martin, finally tonight, a new batch of Turkish troops arrives in Qatar. It doesn't look as if it's going to be a pushover for the Saudis.
Well, it's not going to be enough to stop a Saudi invasion if a Saudi invasion takes place. The purpose of the Turkish troops being there is to turn it into an international incident if that happens. I mean, as we sit here, Tony, on this Friday, the 30th of June 2017, we are really on the brink of an accident here just waiting to happen in Syria, in Qatar, somewhere else completely different. The possibilities here of a major Third World War are staring us all in the face. And there's so much going on that people can't keep up with it all.
Well, when we try and make sure that we stay abreast of it, Qatar is one place, yep. And Syria is another. But it does
and
look
North
as if
Korea.
With the situation in Syria, particularly as it returns to peace, so it almost looks as if another incident is going to have to happen there to make sure the war carries on.
That's right, because the forces we're talking about simply can't accept defeat. The obvious solution, if you had a rational people running the West, is to just accept defeat, shake hands with Putin, shake hands with Assad, try and sort the problem out, but that's not going to happen.
Why don't they do that?
Because they don't make money out of making peace, Tony. They never have.
Isn't it a criminal elite that they're scared?
Yes,
that if there is
criminal,
any kind of... a minute, hang on, let me finish. If there is any real democracy, those people running the show would be under arrest.
They would indeed, and they are terrorists and drug dealers and murderers. But ultimately, we're going to have to deal with them, and it's going to have to be dealt with by civilian police officers working under the direction of democratic forces.
Do you see any parallels with the beginning of the First World War or the Second World War? Certainly economically, there seem to be similarities.
It's the same sort of setup, but on steroids. And of course, this one is going to be the big one. It's going to make the other two look like a walk in the park.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights. Here this week with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Eastern Afzal Shah. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, to Carter Heydrich, and to Robert Atkinson from Kensington and Chelsea Council in the first hour too. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car, iPlayer, anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy Quain's Saturday edition tomorrow morning at 10. And get the real musical deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. I'll leave you with music from 1992, Chrissy Hynde and Mood Swings. Do please join us at the Politics Show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Center.